As most of us get into bed and fall asleep at night, many Canadians get up and get ready for work. They are security guards, night cooks, machine operators, assembly line workers, and healthcare professionals. In Canada, the percentage of laborers working rotating evening or night shifts has risen steadily since the mid-1990s. Evidence is emerging, however, that shift workers are at increased risk of workplace injury and cardiovascular disease. On today's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective, we'll look at why shift work is increasing, who benefits, who gets sick, and why. Sick people or a sick society?
You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
All right. Here with me in studio is Wayne Luchuk. He's a professor in the School of Labor Studies and the Department of Economics at McMaster University. Welcome, Professor Luchuk.
Hi.
Hi. So your research focuses on precarious employment and its impact on workers' health. What exactly do you mean when you use the term precarious health?
Yeah. Well, we're talking about a group of workers who don't have a permanent job. So they tend to be employed through temporary employment agencies on short-term contracts. Maybe they own accounts, self-employed, so they don't have any employees, but they sort of work out of their basement. And they're very different from the workers, the norm of, the 1950s and the 1960s, when you got a job at Stelco or Ford or even in the public sector. And once you got that job and you were, say, 20 or 25, you could expect to stay there for 25 or 30 years. That's increasingly becoming less likely for the young worker today.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me about how this change came about?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a gradual shift over the last 10 or 15 years, and employers have argued that they're responding to competitive pressures as we move to free trade, and they're being forced to compete with offshore labor, which is sometimes cheaper. They've decided that they can no longer afford the sort of kind of permanent employment relationship. And with that, they've jettisoned things like pensions, and so we're seeing right here in our community today a lockout of the U.S. steel workers, and the issue there is over the continuation of their pension plans. They can no longer provide health benefits and things like that. And so what we're finding is workers, in a sense, they become commodities. They're bought and sold on the open market, and there's not a long-term permanent relationship. And that's why what we've been writing about, we've been talking about working without commitments, a new style of work in which neither the employer has a long-term commitment to the employee, but at the same time, the employee doesn't have a long-term commitment to the employer. And what we're arguing that there are serious health implications of that form of social arrangement.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, when we talk about commitment, the consumer is also implicated, right? How does this relate to the way we buy things today?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for the consumer, a lot of this is really quite invisible. What the consumer does, it goes into the shop and looks for quality product at a low price. And probably what we're seeing is prices are, and a number of commodities are falling. But that's because workers are no longer being treated as someone that would be there permanently. So they don't have the kind of pensions and the benefits, and in some cases, wages. So in our own work, we found that 80% of workers who we'd classify as precarious have no benefit other than the hourly wage that they're getting. They have no dental care, no eyeglasses, no pension. If they're sick, they don't get paid. If they become injured, well, then the contract is just terminated, and that's the end of their employment.
Mm-hmm. And have you looked at all at the demographics of who are these laborers?
Mm-hmm. Well, 20 years ago, we would have thought of this as sort of the Kelly girl, the temp agency, so secretaries filling in, mainly women. And that's now fundamentally changed. So, in fact, our own research is showing is that while many immigrants that's sort of their first access to employment is through the precarious labor market, and many women continue to be employed in precarious employment as they have been for 20 or 30 years, the change is increasingly men are now being employed employed in precarious employment at all as well. Often many of the professions, so many of our precariously employed are the highly educated. It's in new industries like computer software and accounting, et cetera, that you find this is a new form of working. And so it's spread across our entire economy. It's not located in any one group or any one set of workers with certain characteristics.
Mm-hmm. And you talked briefly about temporary workers. I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little bit more about that for people who might not know about the people who come to Canada and work here.
Well, there's two kinds of temporary workers. So there's one group of temporary workers who are temporary immigrant workers. So they're given basically a visa which allows them to work here for X amount of time in a specific job. And they tend to be actually very vulnerable because often their continuation of employment in Canada depends on their continuation of employment with the specific employer who has agreed to bring them over. So they're not free to move around. So you can imagine how vulnerable that is. But what I'm talking about here is a much broader class of workers. It's not just immigrant workers. It's workers who find their employment through temporary employment agencies, which 25 years ago were not very common. But today, increasingly, many firms only employ through temporary employment agencies. And so we now have whole factories where every worker in there is employed through a temporary employment agency.
Mm-hmm. And that's done so that they have kind of a fixed-term contract?
Often these workers will be there for 6 months or 3 months or sometimes even shorter. And what it basically means is at the end of the contract, they have no commitment for employment after that. That's what we talk about when we're working without commitments. And so while our labor law is built to offer protection to workers in permanent employment, unfair dismissal, there's no such thing as unfair non-renewal of your contract. So if for whatever reason the employer doesn't like you because of the way you dress or the way you talk or your political views or whatever, they can just end the contract and there's no commitment to rehire again. And so often you'll find these workers being sent out and not have their contracts renewed while some other workers brought in to do the work that they were doing before.
So you've co-written a book with Marley Clark and Alice DeWolf entitled Working Without Commitments, Precarious Employment and Health. Can you tell me a little bit about how you conducted that research?
Mm-hmm. Well, we did a population survey based in the region from Hamilton to Oshawa, including Toronto, and we tried to make it as random as possible. So we actually put postcards in people's mailboxes and invited them to participate. And we got about 2,000 people to respond back. And, you know, we did a survey with them, and then with about 100 of those, we did a short interview with them. And the results are really, I mean, they're quite startling. What it shows is that simply being in insecure employment is not necessarily bad. I mean, there's downsides to having a permanent job, of having to get up every morning and go to work and subject yourself to certain kinds of stresses and physical hazards. But what we did find is a large group of the insecurely employed who feel trapped, are in low-paid jobs, don't see any way of getting out of this, and they're suffering horrific health problems. And what we call this group is we call these group exposed to employment strain. So it's the problem of how they find work, how they keep work, how they renegotiate its terms and conditions every once in a while, that's fundamentally changing. So again, think of the old manufacturing worker or someone in the public sector or even tenured faculty here in the university. You know, as long as you didn't sort of punch someone in the nose or stop doing your job, you basically kept your job. And you knew every once in a while the terms and conditions would be renegotiated. But if you're in one of these precarious jobs, after 6 months your contract ends, you don't know where you're going to be working, who you're going to be working with, whether the pay is going to go up or down, what the shift schedule is. You know, you're trying to organize daycare and all these things. And so it just puts a horrific stress load on these individuals.
Mm-hmm. So what kinds of health impacts do you see caused by that stress?
Well, we find that those who are exposed to what we call this employment strain, which is sort of a combination of very insecure employment, and you're out there looking for work and trying to find a new job all the time, these people are twice as likely to report mental health problems, three times as likely to report sleep problems, headaches related to work, twice as likely to say that they're fatigued after work. So there's a whole range of these sort of stress-related health problems that they're reporting to us.
Mm-hmm. And so where do you see this going? Do you see a need for legislation on this issue, or do you see more of a I guess, kind of a labor social movement building?
I mean, that's a good question. I think what's at least clear to me is that we're not going back to the 1950s. So I'm not sure that we're going back to the world where, you know, you got your first job after 25 and you stay there for 30 or 35 years. I mean, there were downsides to that. I mean, that wasn't a utopia by any stretch of the imagination. And it was also very gendered. So often women weren't given access to that kind of employment. So I don't see us going back there. But I think what we need to recognize is that now increasingly people are going to have gaps in their employment, so that we're going to need better unemployment insurance to bridge them between jobs. They're going to be changing jobs, so we need better retraining programs. I don't think we can any longer rely on employers to cover things like pensions and health care and dental and training, because, you know, if they're employing someone for a short term, they have no incentive to do those things either. So I think we're going to have to find new ways of collectively providing those benefits. And I think last is a question of unions. I mean, unions are very much a creature of the kind of standard employment relationship, permanent full-time work. They're going to have to find ways of representing this new class of worker who hops from employer to employer on a regular basis. And they're still searching, I think, for the way to move forward on that issue.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen any examples of a union that tries to incorporate temporary workers?
Oh, certainly. There are a number of workers in these sorts of situations are in unions. Mm-hmm. You know, the problem is the employer has such leverage on these workers. But so one example, I think, which is an interesting historical example, is in the construction industry. This kind of temporary employment has long been a feature. So carpenters and plumbers and electricians, they'd work on one building. And once the electrical work is done in that building, that job is basically over. And so there, the union actually acts as a hiring hall. So employers come to the union and say, we need 8 electricians. And the union has a list, and the 8 electricians at the top, they get that job. It may last for 3 months. It may last for 3 weeks. And then the employer makes a contribution to their pension plan, to their health benefits, which is held by the union. And it's actually the union that delivers these pension benefits and health benefits, because the employment is always short-term. So there's a model out there already that we could use to improve the situation of workers in precarious employment.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to the health of workers, do we see impacts on the work itself and the productivity of work itself?
Well, I mean, when we talk about working without commitments, it's a two-way street. It's both the employer, their commitments to their workers has been reduced, but the worker's commitment to the employer has been reduced as well. So, you know, if you're only there for 3 months, then you might say, well, look, I don't have that commitment to go the extra mile. And I think what we saw during, you know, the economic crisis is that when firms got themselves in trouble, these precarious workers, they were the first ones to jump ship and go to someplace else rather than sticking around and trying to save the company. So I think that's one problem. The other problem is, I think, the lack of focus on training. I mean, who's going to train up these workers to move into middle and higher level jobs as they get older? Again, the employer doesn't have that incentive to offer the kind of training that these people need. They may not be able to fund it themselves. And so I think in 10 or 15 years, we could find ourselves with a real skill gap from the spread of precarious employment, which would have negative effects on productivity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming in today, Wayne. Again, Wayne is a professor in the School of Labor Studies in the Department of Economics at McMaster University.
My pleasure.
Great. Up next, we've got The Tragically Hip, The Dark One. You're on the line. We have Dr. Scheer, who's an assistant professor of medicine at the Harvard Medical School and the associate director of medical chronobiology at Brigham and Women's Hospital.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, how are you?
Good, thanks. So, Dr. Scheer, we've just been talking about how precarious employment seems to be associated with poor health outcomes. I mean, you've conducted some research on the biological mechanisms behind these adverse health outcomes. Can you tell us about the concept of circadian rhythms and how these change when one's working in shift work?
Sure. So circadian rhythms are rhythms that are generated by the body, so independent of changes in environment and behavior. And so they regulate our daily behaviors and physiology, and the circadian system is thought to optimally prepare the body for the upcoming daily activities. And in shift work, what we know is that the internal body clock, this circadian system, is typically misaligned, so it's not in alignment with the behavioral sleep-wake cycle, including not only the sleep-wake cycle, but also the feeding-fasting cycle, changes in body posture, etc. And so we, in our study that was published last year in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, looked at whether such misalignment could explain in part the observation that shift workers have increased risk for diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular disease. And previous studies haven't been able to really explain these observations. They haven't been able to fully account for these observations looking at differences in lifestyle or socioeconomic status. So what we did is we simulated, or we looked at different degrees of circadian misalignment in a highly controlled in-laboratory study.
Mm-hmm. And how did you do that? How did you subject the subjects to misalignment?
Sure. So what we did is we had people live on a 28-hour day, basically meaning that people woke up every day 4 hours later. And the biological clock cannot keep up with such a very long day. So it will continue ticking along at its inherent rate of about 24 hours. And so then subsequently you can mathematically separate the influence of the behaviors, including sleep-wake and feeding-fasting, from the internal body clock rhythm. And you can look at what happens when these two are misaligned, when they're so we look specifically at what happens when the body clock and the behaviors are 12 hours out of alignment.
Mm-hmm. And in a normal person, what is the function of a circadian rhythm? What kinds of things does it take care of?
Sure. So it controls body temperature, which is a very well-known one. About half the day-night pattern that you observe is generated by the body clock, and the other one is the other half is due to the sleep-wake cycle and behaviors and rest. So all due to behavior and environment. Other examples are hormones. The most famous example regulated by the body clock is melatonin, but also cortisol, which people often refer to as a stress hormone, is actually very strongly circadianly regulated.
Okay, so in your study, you had subjects, and they had a misaligned circadian rhythm, and then what did you look at?
So we focused on variables, physiological measures that are involved in regulation of body weight, glucose metabolism, and blood pressure, of course, because these are highly relevant for the increased risk for obesity, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. So for the measure of energy balance, hunger, and appetite, we looked at the hormone leptin. And leptin is a hormone that's released by fat tissue, and that signals satiety. So basically, it's a stop signal to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we found when people were misaligned is that these levels of leptin went down. So in the long run, we would predict that there is increased hunger and appetite, increased food intake, and potentially could contribute to explaining the increased risk of the development of obesity in shift workers.
Okay.
Secondly, we looked at, as I said, glucose regulation. So what we found was that glucose increased much more following a meal when people were misaligned. And so there was signs of decreased sensitivity to insulin, and these are risk factors for the development of diabetes. And we also found a slight increase in blood pressure during the wake episode. And so in the long run, in a vulnerable population, could contribute to increased cardiovascular risk.
Okay, so when we talk about people who might have misaligned circadian rhythms, we're talking about people who might be working shift work, but are there other examples of activities that would misalign your circadian rhythm?
Yeah, so there's milder forms of this. Of course, we all have experienced jet lag. So this is a temporary misalignment between your body clock and the new time zone, which, we typically try to adjust ourselves to the new time zone, but especially if it's many hours difference, then this can be problematic. And so you notice this not only by difficulty falling asleep and feeling tired and sleepy during the wake time, but also there are likely physiological changes going on that we are not fully aware of. But these, you know, these are temporary changes following shift work that typically revert back. It takes about 1 day per 1 hour of time zone shift. Other examples are people suffering from advanced or delayed sleep phase syndrome, and milder versions are of these. You could think of morning people and evening people. So people who have either difficulty to stay up late and they actually wake up very early, which are the morning people, and vice versa, evening people or owls, morning people referred to as larks. Mm-hmm. For evening people, they have difficulties to get up in the morning and they have difficulty to fall asleep in the evening. And there's some evidence to indicate that the circadian system is partially underlying these differences. And so these are some other examples of people who may show physiological changes because their circadian system is not optimally in alignment with their desired sleep-wake cycle.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the shift workers, would they be seeing symptoms? How soon would they see symptoms, or would they see any?
Well, the thing that surprised us really was that we observed changes within just 3 days. Now, no studies have been done to look at such short time consequences of starting doing shift work. But we're initiating now a study to look in shift workers what actually happens. There have been some studies that show that over years of doing shift work, there is an increased risk for cardiovascular risk. But it's complicated because there's also a selection bias going on. So people who notice that they can't cope anymore with shift work, they will stop doing shift work. So cross-sectional studies are not good at assessing this. So future studies are really necessary to look at the dynamics.
Mm-hmm. Because these levels that we're seeing increased or decreased, the immediate physiological responses of the body will have an impact on more long-term things like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, etc., but someone might not experience those right away. Is that right?
Correct. And you know, you are probably unaware of many of these changes. Like, you may be unaware that you're glucose regulation is no longer functioning properly. You may also be unaware that your blood pressure is rising. So these are things you don't quickly notice because of symptoms. So you may notice these only when you go for a checkup with your PCP.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking to us today, Dr. Scheer.
It was my pleasure, Nikki.
Great.